You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, May 22nd, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, immigration passes through its first hurdle, or I should say immigration reform. Apple on the Hill. Yesterday, just more evidence on how we're being fleeced by corporations not paying their share of taxes. More on the criminalization of investigative reporting in this country. Update on the Occupy Our Homes protest in front of the Department of Justice yesterday, and strikes in D.C. yesterday. Also, Richard doing okay, poor not so much. Don't hold your breath for lawmakers to do anything about our job situation in this country. Also, Latino voters just simply don't get the same response when they ask questions. All that and more on the program today. It's just me, folks. Just I today, because we had too much news to get through. We're going to start with something that is just... look, the Oklahoma tornadoes, people are... fortunately, the initial... counts of those killed were reduced to just 24, although that's not, it's fortunate that it wasn't higher. Let's put it that way. And some of the stuff we've seen on the television has been very touching. Apparently the teachers involved in that school that was leveled were incredibly heroic. And, of course, they deserve our scorn because they belong to a union. And these people are just another example of just why we should get rid of teachers' unions, because these people are just trying to get away with it. They don't even work during the summers, these teachers, apparently. But that aside, there was an amazing moment. I mean, look. I certainly understand why the media covers these things so intently, and they are very dramatic incidents. There are moments, however, where this coverage turns into some type of weird porn of some sorts. And in the desperate attempt to get the most dramatic of post-tornado footage, and the one that's going to get the headline and cut through all the noise. We see Wolf Blitzer just dropping to a stunning new low. He is out in front of a bunch of wreckage with a mother and her young baby, I guess he's a toddler, really. And this is Wolf Blitzer interviewing her. And it's not enough. At some point in this interview, he realizes, I got to get more. And just listen.
Anders is
Brian.
Less...
Brian.
Yeah, Brian. You like Brian, huh? That's your dad. Well, we're happy you're here. You guys did a great job.
Yeah.
And I guess you got to thank the Lord, right?
Yeah.
Do you thank the Lord for that split-second decision?
I'm actually an atheist.
Oh, you are. All right. Don't thank the Lord. But you made the right call.
Yeah. Yep. We are here, and you know, I don't blame anybody for thanking the Lord.
Of course not. Anders, want to try one more time?
All right, there you have it, folks. You thank the Lord, don't you? I mean, this is what's going through Wolf Blitzer's mind in that one brief moment, that just a millisecond, where he's like, yeah, you thank the Lord, right? You're here, and he goes, do you thank the Lord? And I don't know if Wolf is. Particularly religious. You know, I don't know what his former sort of flacking for AIPAC reveals about this, but I think what is really revealed in this moment is the pressure that these morons feel to, like, get that one headline. She thanks the Lord! Explicitly so. I actually asked that question twice, and that's how I elicited that comment. And, well, just God bless her. She was so, she handled it so way. She handled it so nicely. God bless her. Just God bless her. a little slow on the uptake there, guys.
I was a little bit slow there.
That was a little bit more of like.
Just, well, God
gotta
bless.
You got to thank
God,
the Lord.
God
for
bless
her,
voice. Her heart. Folks, we'll take your phone calls early today at 646-257-3920 as we...
What you should have said to us was, guys, do you think God blessed her?
Yes. Well, I thought it was very Christian of her to say that other people could bless the Lord. That was extremely Christian of her. She was... can we just play that one more time?
Yeah.
Can we just play that one more time for my own... The tone where he just sort of turns like, oh, wait, oh, geez, I got a story here. Wait a second. Good.
Anders is
Brian.
Less...
Brian.
Yeah, Brian. You like Brian, huh? That's your dad. Well, we're happy you're here. You guys did a great job.
Yeah.
And I guess you got to thank the Lord, right?
Yeah.
Do you thank the Lord for that split second decision?
I'm actually an atheist.
Oh, you are. All right. Don't thank the Lord. But you made the right call.
Yeah. Yep. We are here. And...
Surprise!
There you go. Leave this up for me, please.
Sorry about that.
Don't ride that thing. So that was quite enjoyable, and
it was actually sweet for a few seconds, which I think is what made it even funnier.
Yes,
it's a very kind of human thing going on. Oh, was it the Lord, right?
Yeah, it was weird. It was very weird on how pointed he had to turn in there. Got to ask that question. That's what I learned in journalism school.
I like his laughter when she says, I'm actually an atheist. It's kind of like, whoa, boy.
Oh, this could have gotten uncomfortable. All right, so Apple was on the Hill yesterday, Tim Cook, and we played you the clip of Rand Paul, who was so offended by the idea that a successful company could be questioned as to just their tax process. We all know how big the government is. Some of these bills are just over hundreds of pages. And so this was terribly offensive to Rand Paul. The story in which, and we covered this slightly, I believe, in the better half yesterday, but I want to be explicit about what Apple was doing. I've seen differing reports, but up to $74 billion was, and I don't even know if you could accurately say this was repatriated, but up to $74 billion over the course of a 3-year period was made by Apple, and they paid $0 in taxes on it. All perfectly legal under a tax system that has been shot full of holes by corporate lobbyists and by the overarching sense that taxes are some type of burden as opposed to simply the dues that one pays to be a part of society. A Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations basically outlined how Apple managed to avoid paying taxes on a huge dollar figure, which represented about 61% of Apple's total revenue just last year. And apparently what Apple did is they set up a Apple's Operations International. It is registered in Cork, Ireland, but has no physical presence at that or any other address, according to the report. The entity has existed for 30 years and has never had a single employee. There are three people on its board, all Apple employees. Two live in California. 32 of 33 board meetings took place in Cupertino, and the Irish director participated in seven of it. Its assets are managed by a Nevada company and held in bank accounts in New York. Because it is not managed and controlled in Ireland, Ireland does not tax its earnings. Because the company is not registered in the United States, it owes no American taxes. The affiliate received over $30 billion in dividend income. So according to the report, according to Apple, AOIs, this is Apple Operations International's, net income is made up of 30% of Apple's total worldwide net profits from 2009 to 2011, yet Apple also disclosed that it did not pay any corporate tax income to any national government. Apparently, what Apple also does is they hold a large chunk of its intellectual property in low-tax Irish affiliates as well. So they're subject to a very small Irish tax there on their intellectual property. And that is essentially how they assemble and design their products. Just the idea of it. And of course, they get their products from all across the world. And the profits for their construction of these Apple computers is run through those affiliates where the IP is registered. So this is all perfectly legal, but it also shows just how problematic our tax code is. And of course, Tim Cook was on the Hill yesterday saying, well, you know, look, I'm not going to give you any taxes from these profits unless you lower the tax rate in this country. And in that case, we're still going to keep the profits offshore and still hide them from you. But at least some of our other affiliates, the rest of the income that we get will be taxed at a lower rate. Now, recall that in 2004, the Bush administration and Republicans, which controlled both houses of our government at that time, or I should say of Congress, passed the American Job Creation Act. It was a one-time repatriation of overseas profits, of profits that had been parked overseas, that would reduce the corporate tax rate of these corporations by 30%. They would be subject to 35% of corporate tax rates, but if they repatriated their profits, which they'd been keeping offshore, they could bring them back at a 5% rate. Now, understand that the ability for corporations to wait and hide, essentially, or keep their money, their profits offshore, American companies, for as long as they want and determine when they want to bring this back, was a function of a law passed during the Eisenhower administration. It used to be an American corporation doing business overseas would have to repatriate their money every year, like anyone else, and be subject to taxes. In an effort to help U.S. companies develop business around the world, and ostensibly to help the rest of the world recover from World War II, corporations were given a break. They were basically allowed to keep their money offshore and bring it back when they wanted to. and be subject to no taxes until they repatriated that money, which allowed them essentially to take a lot of those profits and basically shift them back into their overseas operations and avoid taxes. But if they wanted to bring back profits, they would have to pay taxes ultimately. So this American Job Creation Act of 04 was to allow a one-time repatriation holiday that was supposed to provide all sorts of jobs for Americans. Also, I mean, that was the name of the act. It was supposed to provide research and development to grow our economy, to prove just how the free market, the private markets could function if only they didn't have this horrible tax burden. However, a study by the National Bureau of Economic Research found that 92% of the repatriated cash was used not to hire new employees, not to invest in capital infrastructure, not to provide R&D, but instead was used to pay for dividends, share buybacks, or executive bonuses.
Surprise, surprise.
And that was done so even by the companies that lobbied so intensely, had made so many promises written in sand as to what they would do with that money. And in fact, many of those same companies had thousands upon thousands of layoffs. Now, of course, we won't see any meaningful reform that captures these literally trillions of dollars, which should be in the coffers of our government's general fund and being used to actually invest in creating jobs in this country. But also understand, for those of you, this is a great time for a libertarian to call in and tell me why I'm so wrong. But before you do, you should know that the Washington Post earlier this year analyzed 30 large companies listed on the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And they found that their tax rates have fallen even as their profits have risen, and that relative to the late 60s and early 70s, companies listed on the current Dow 30 routinely cited U.S. federal tax expenses that were 25 to 50% of their worldwide profits. Now, most of them are reporting less than half of that share. So, as a function of profits, these corporations are paying less taxes than they have at presumably any other time in the past nearly 75 years. Not only that, as a function of GDP, corporate tax revenues are at historic lows as a percentage of GDP, albeit going back only to World War II. So at no time have U.S. corporations enjoyed lower effective tax rates than they enjoy now. So we have a problem, and it is not that American corporations can't compete. How is those trickle-down economics, how is that working for you folks? Because we also have a story in the Washington Post today which speaks of the urgency in which we are seeing lawmakers approach the economic situation in this country. Washington has all but abandoned efforts to help the economy recover faster, and lawmakers don't seem worried that voters will punish them for it at all. We still have by the most conservative estimates, nearly 12 million Americans still looking for work. More than 4 million people have been unemployed for over 6 months. In April, two-thirds of Americans told the Washington Post ABC News poll that jobs were difficult to find in their communities. But lawmakers appear to feel little electoral pressure to address those concerns. We saw just a week or two ago that polls show Americans still feel creation of jobs should be job number one for our lawmakers. It's not even remotely close. The House has approved only three bills, if you include a bill to repeal President Obama's Affordable Care Act that could even be vaguely, remotely considered to be economic policy measures. None, of course, have been signed into law because these were all just preening. But the real issue here is that for the donor class, those people who essentially are the most responded to by both parties in our government, wealthy Americans are feeling a stock market fuel surge of optimism about the economy. In other words, the rich are getting richer, and thus the economy is taking a back seat, because we really do have two definitions of a good economy in this country. One is an economy that provides as low as you can go in terms of unemployment, where you have the most broad-based support and the most broad-based, I guess, sense that the economy is doing well. And then the other is basically, how is the economy measured by the richest amongst us? And the problem we have now is that corporations' profits are through the roof. The stock market is also at new highs. And thus we see complete inaction by our lawmakers. 52% of white Americans earning $50,000 a year or more are optimistic about the national economy. A 13 percentage point increase from December, according to the Washington Post ABC News poll, which tracks the performance of Standard & Poor's 500 stock index. So we're going to hear more about Benghazi or the IRS or other trumped up scandals. Perhaps we'll see some immigration reform, because regardless of the fact that both parties can ignore the broad implications of the economy, they cannot ignore demographics in the same way. And in that regard, the Senate Judiciary Committee yesterday, on a 13-5 vote, three Republicans joining 10 Democrats, five Republicans opposing the bill, passed through committee a version of immigration reform which would provide new resources and goals for tightening border security, would require all employers to use a federal database to check the legal status of employees, sets out a path for millions of people now in the country without documentation to become permanent legal residents and eventually citizens. The timeline, rather long, but at least they will have some form of legal status, which could presumably provide them legal protections and take them out of some type of a black market economy. The sticking point, apparently, was that Senator Orrin Hatch wanted some tweaks on the highly educated, basically technical workers, allowing for a higher minimum of visas allowed for those folks. The the bad news is that Republicans were able to maintain their discrimination of gays in this bill, essentially. There were about 28, I mean, I've seen differing numbers, but essentially 28,000 people who are same-sex partners. And Patrick Leahy had signaled that he had intended, or had, I should say, offered an amendment allowing U.S. citizens to apply for permanent resident status on behalf of same-sex partners. Would have affected about 28,000 people. He withdrew that amendment, ostensibly because it would have killed the bill in the committee. Leahy appeared to be rather upset about it. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. He was under pressure from the White House not to offer the amendment. Republicans in the Gang of Eight had said that the provision would lead them to abandon the legislation. Chuck Schumer said that not including the provision amounted to rank discrimination, but ultimately concluded, "I cannot support this amendment if it'll bring down the bill." Al Franken said this is a definition of a Hobson's choice. In my bones, I believe in equality. The rest of the senators asked their aides what that means, Hobson's choice, which is basically just a situation where you really don't have an option. It's a take it or leave it type of situation. But Lindsey Graham reflected the view of his Republican colleagues when he said, "You've got me on immigration. You don't have me on marriage. If you want to keep me on immigration, let's stay on immigration." Now, there was, of course, nothing in this bill that referred to marriage. It was simply affording some level of decency. I don't know if Lindsey Graham is aware that estimates show that perhaps 250,000 of these undocumented immigrants may be homosexual. I don't know if he has a problem with that. The Hatches Amendment raises the minimum of a number of visas annually for high-skilled foreign workers, known as H-1B visas, to 115,000 from 110,000 in the bill. Keeps the maximum at 180,000 a year. It supposedly provides a mechanism which will tweak that number based on conditions in the labor market. The AFL-CIO portrayed Hatch's amendment as being anti-worker. There was many who felt that this was a problem for American workers. But hopefully these people that are let in eventually will become American citizens. And they certainly will be contributing to our tax base. But, of course, this is a way for the high-tech industry to drive down the wages of American tech workers. You know, the knowledge economy, where we're all going to be living in a wonderful sort of white, what color is that? Like a sort of a powder blue collar economy. All right, let's go to the phones. John from Oregon, welcome to the program, John.
Mayor, I had a question and a comment, and my question, lo and behold, you just answered while I was online or waiting for you.
All right, well.
It was on H-1B visa permits, and you just were talking about it.
All right. So what's your comment?
My comment is thank you for having Glenn Greenwald on yesterday. And I saw the segment where he was on Bill Maher's show, and I was just, it brought a smile to my face that he basically schooled Bill Maher on American foreign policy on his own show. And I wish that America would give more credence to journalists such as him, Chris Hedges, Russ Baker, Greg Palast, Rick Perlstein, you know, people like that, instead of getting their news from the clown shows such as Bill Maher, Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert. We need more news, not entertainment.
Yeah, I mean, hope springs eternal. You know, I mean, I think there is value to those guys, frankly. And, you know, I think Colbert, in my opinion, is the most rigorous of them in terms of really the knowledge he brings to the positions he takes. You know, and, you know, I haven't looked at that clip with Greenwald, but Bill Maher his Achilles heel has always been his Islamophobia, which I think sort of emanates from his just sort of general anti-religious position. And it's fine, you know, you don't like religion, that's fine, I think. But to say that there's something intrinsic in a particular religion is ludicrous when you divorce it from the political realities of and the foreign policy realities. I have little doubt if we were consistently invading, you know, Catholic countries and killing hundreds of thousands of Catholics or Jews or Hindus or Buddhists, that we would find that most of our terror issues would be a function of those religions. I mean, you know, you can look at it and see the history of the IRA. Is that a function of Catholicism? Was there something inherent in Catholicism that caused people to blow up shopping centers? I don't think so. The political realities was what fueled it. Religion may at times be an excuse and a means, but it is not the primary driving force. But I appreciate the call, John.
Thank you very much, Sam. The only thing I would add is that I would ask people maybe to look at the books of Chalmers Johnson and the Blowback series.
All right, yes. Or they could become a member of this show and occasionally hear us play the archived interviews that we've done with Chalmers Johnson. You know, pick them, one or the other, if you want. Let's turn for a moment, shall we, to the to just some of the fallout from this Justice Department investigation into the alleged State Department leaker, or the guy, I guess, who was a consultant to the State Department, and the warrant that the Department of Justice secured during this investigation, saying that James Rosen, the Washington correspondent for Fox News, yes, I know, was a potential co-conspirator, an aider and an abettor to this leak because and based solely on what he did in the course of his reporting. Not that there was anything illegal in the actions that he took, but simply in that he was doing what investigative reporters do, trying to get information from a source. Understand that under this theory, the Department of Justice could indict this guy under the Espionage Act. And sadly, I mean, the most of the outrage that we're seeing on this, although it is cut across all ideological the across the ideological spectrum is on Fox News. And there's nothing more annoying than watching these morons on Fox News try and talk about this when, of course, you know, if this was a reporter from anywhere else, they would be cheering the administration on at this point. But be that as it may, what has been also disturbing is to watch some center-left journalists sort of poo-poo this for reasons that are sort of inexplicable. I mean, I understand that partisans hate the fact that this is a Fox News reporter. And I share that sort of ambivalence. But the reality is that, A, based upon what we know about the Obama administration, the way they've gone after leakers, based upon what we know about the Department of Justice and the way they've gone after reporters, there's no reason to think that in any way this is confined to this one journalist. There's also no reason to believe, and I think there's every reason to believe, that this is precedent setting. That if it's allowed to stand, it has set a precedent. And am I up to C or D? What it clearly has done has already had an effect on national security reporting, because it has struck the fear of God in these national security investigative reporters. We know that James Risen is already still embroiled in one of these investigations. We know that WikiLeaks continues to be investigated by a grand jury, although they seem to not be able to come up with anything. There's no reason to believe there isn't more of this going on. And Josh Marshall writes a piece based upon a piece written by Jack Schaefer in Reuters, and I have respect for both of these guys, but they both sort of take this position that, yes, a line has been crossed. It sort of seems bad. Marshall tries to mitigate it by saying reporters and anyone who believes in the First Amendment is right to find this worrisome, but it's wrong to suggest that using a legal argument to get a warrant is the same as trying to charge Rosen with a crime. It's simply not the same. Now, this seems to be a bit of a straw man, because I don't know that anybody's saying that. But certainly, arguing in a warrant that the activities, and everybody seems to stipulate as to what the activities Rosen engaged in, and nobody seems to claim that those activities on their own are in any way afoul of the law, but simply doing those activities, trying to send codes through email, trying to make it look like they weren't talking to each other at the State Department, you know, leaving at different times as they met with each other from different places. None of those things are illegal. So trying to, but making the case in the context of a warrant that this activity is criminal in and of itself because of the person he is talking to and the information he may or may not get, seems to at least lay the predicate for charges. The administration may say, well, we just chose not to prosecute. They still could prosecute him, theoretically. But that doesn't mean that they don't view as his activities as being criminal. And that doesn't mean that they don't reserve the right to prosecute him based upon those activities. This is more or less unprecedented. The only sighting that I can find anywhere of anything that's even remotely close to this Glenn Greenwald mentioned yesterday that has been brought up by the legal counsel for the New York Times during the Watergate, during the Pentagon hearings, was the Nixon administration's attempt to target the reporter who reported on these Pentagon papers. And that fell short because everybody thought it was so toxic. So Marshall goes on to say, after that, and maybe I'm just not reading it, maybe I'm just not getting it, but he basically echoes what Jack Schaefer is saying, is that James Rosen seems like a bad reporter. His tradecraft was rookie-ish. That you don't use email accounts like that. That you don't visit at the State Department. You go and meet at a cafe or I don't know. And none of that seems relevant to the situation at hand here at all. I mean, if the argument is that what this guy did just by being a reporter makes him an abettor and co-conspirator by the fact that he used asterisks in a secret code in his email is what constitutes being an aider and abettor and a co-conspirator. If this guy was better at his tradecraft, in other words, was smart enough to do what Petraeus did with his lover by setting up a dummy email account where they just go in and do drafts and nothing's sent and there's no ISP, isn't that actually evidence of more wrongdoing? If this guy is a co-conspirator because he was trying to hide his communications, albeit poorly and in a rookie-ish and basic level, remedial level, then if someone's using more sophisticated techniques, aren't they even more guilty? Aren't they even more a co-conspirator and aider and abettor? I just don't understand it. He goes on to talk about, you know, Rosen's journalistic technique. That seems wholly irrelevant here. Because the Department of Justice is not making the case that his technique is what got him into trouble. Or I should say, the lack of high-level technique of acumen is what got him into trouble. No, the activities themselves got him into trouble. The reporting got him into trouble. So I just don't see how it's relevant that this guy was supposedly a bad reporter. I have no doubt. Listen, I certainly don't need much convincing that somebody who's working for Fox is a crappy reporter, because the conservative machine does not turn out terribly good reporters because of the nature in which they are promoted. But that doesn't seem to be neither here nor there in this question.
There's some analogy, I think, between that response to Rosen and how WikiLeaks was treated, which is that if you can turn the conversation away to the real core content and get it on presentational and brand issues, essentially, you could just obfuscate the whole thing.
And credentials.
And credentialism. It's the same focus on optics around an issue that goes way beyond your personal feelings about any of these people.
And then Josh finishes with, the DOJ didn't indict anyone or seemingly make any effort to. I think he's talking about, in the case of the AP reporters and Rosen, he's talking, I think, specifically about the reporters. I don't know how he can say they seemingly didn't make any effort to. They promoted the theory that this guy was a criminal co-conspirator to get a warrant and search his emails, not just, you know, read them, to tap his phone lines, to apparently, I don't know if this is true, but tapped the phone lines of his parents. This is according to Fox News. I don't know if that's true or not, but he writes, they took a step I think they should not have taken. But they did so, putting together a case, a government employee who was more or less in plain sight. Thanks to Rosen, in part, leaked what looks to have been highly classified information about U.S. spy networks overseas. Well, that's all well and good, but then why do you have to promote the theory that reporting is a co-conspirator? They could have subpoenaed his stuff. They could have made the argument that this warrant is essential because this guy is has there's evidence here. And at one point, Marshall makes the case that it's important to note that the DOJ didn't do that. Rosen wasn't charged with anything. He apparently didn't even know this had happened until the piece was published in the Washington Post over the weekend. How is that a defense? That if it's done in secret and you don't know that your stuff has been tapped or read, it's not really that big of a deal. But the government did walk up to the line by suggesting the theory that Rosen himself had committed a crime in order to get her. They didn't suggest the theory. They didn't suggest the theory. They made an assertion. They asserted he was a co-conspirator. Or that his activities, which have been stipulated, potentially made him a co-conspirator. What did the DOJ not know at that time? They didn't present anything in that warrant that would suggest that they had suspicions he had done something other than what we have all stipulated he did. So it's really troublesome to see this poo-pooed by journalists. I don't know if anything positive is going to come out of it because now it's, you know, now the conservatives see that there might be a chance to sort of go after the Obama administration in this accord. But hope springs eternal that maybe... maybe, I don't know, some Republican will just offer some legislation that says, yeah, we really do got to protect the media here.
Hope does spring eternal.
I mean, why, it seems
this
to me,
is the only
seems
one.
To me you could have a statute that says the act of journalism, if it does not involve anything else that is in the criminal code, cannot be considered the basis of a warrant, cannot be considered the basis of a criminal charge.
You could write this in a paragraph, and there's no national security exemption for any of it. That would be the key thing to insert.
Yes, or that the national security exemption needs to be actually adjudicated in front of a judge, as opposed to just a, you know, federal magistrate who's...
It's a big problem, because this is just going to get...
notary public.
...rolled in with the IRS and the Benghazi stuff. And this one is much more significant.
Yes.
Very distinct.
But they're not going to go after, I mean, the Republicans are just ultimately not going to go after the real thing, because the IRS stuff gives them much more legs. And the IRS stuff, I can't believe how overblown it is. Yes, maybe there should be some people fired because they were incompetent at their job. And really, the incompetence seems to be of dealing with this information. But I'm not even sure that of that, frankly. Let's take a break. When we go into the better half, can't believe I gave people another 9 minutes of programming. God, I've got to take a marketing course, or I've got to take some type of entrepreneurial course. I'm not even, no plea for memberships today, because it doesn't seem to work. People don't respond. I don't quite get it. All right, let's head into the better half of the program, in which I will take your phone call, 646-257-3920. I will read your IMs. We will talk about the story of how federal funding cuts led to a woman being raped. I mean, I don't know how else to put that.
It's just unbelievable.
It's an unbelievable story.
Unbelievable.
Stunning.
We will talk about stunning. We will talk about a study which shows the bias that Latinos face when just trying to get information about voting. Maybe we'll get to that story about the right-wing French historian who shot himself in the face to protest gay marriage. That's really the story.
In Notre Dame, in the cathedral.
In the cathedral.
I mean, this is a pretty...
Some drama there.
French always big drama.
Also, just the... It's almost too painful to read. Bill Keller, you remember him. He's the guy who sat atop the heap of lies that got us into Iraq. He has found a solution, folks, to all of this scandal-mongering that we hear about the IRS. And that, of course, is to bring back Ken Starr. I kid you not, ladies and gentlemen. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back after this. If you're on the phone, just hold on. We'll get to you in a moment. 646-257-3920.